her kommer den tredje og sidste udsendelse i en udsendelsesrække på tre om EU's institutioner. Den første var om EU-domstolen og EU-retten, den anden om EU-revisionsretten. Alle tre er beliggende i Luxembourg, mens den sidste samtale er med den irske EU-ombudskvinde Emily O'Reilly, som europakorrespondent Peter von Kohl besøgte på hendes kontor i Europaparlamentets Vaclav-Havel-bygning i parlamentets hjemby i Strasbourg i Frankrig. Samtalen foregår på engelsk. Udsendelsesrækken om EU's institutioner er støttet af Europanævnet.
Mrs. O'Reilly, I have read your report from last year, and I was astonished. There are so many things you have to deal with. I know you have a quite efficient staff, but still, you have to be here and there and everywhere, correct?
Yes, and I have to confess that sometimes I'm quite astonished myself when I read the annual report and see the breadth of the work that we collectively have done for the year. I suppose on a day-to-day basis, you know, you're not collating it as such, and then at the end of the year you see the breadth of the work that you've done. I suppose that really reflects complaints that we get, which can come from the rather mundane, you know, the Commission hasn't responded to my letter, or to issues that are far more complex. So we do everything from staff cases to human rights violations, if there has been an alleged breach of the Charter of Fundamental Rights, and in between we do transparency, we do conflicts of interests, we do, you know, the
everything connected to
everything,
the parliamentary
exactly.
Library.
Yes.
But there had to be some highlights, both on the bad side and on the good side. The bad side, Martin Selmayr, or were there even other to be bad?
Well, we did get, obviously, a lot of people in Europe now know about the case concerning the Commission and the appointment of Martin Selmayr as Secretary General. It became quite a cause célèbre, not through the doings of the European Ombudsman, but simply because, obviously, he was a very high-profile and important civil servant. He was then chef de cabinet to Commission President Juncker, and then he was appointed Secretary General of the Commission, the biggest post really in the institutional EU, I suppose you could call it, and there were questions asked about the way in which the competition had been conducted. So we got a number of complaints from MEPs. I think there were two groups in particular, one French, I think, and the other Dutch. So we went about doing a normal investigation. It's important to point out that we weren't investigating Mr. Selmayr, we were investigating the Commission's response to it. I'm sure he didn't feel it that way, I can understand that, but that was what we were looking at. It was how the Commission organised the appointment. So we did it. I remember saying to my colleagues at the outset, I said, we're not going to editorialise about this. This is about the facts. So one of the powers that I have, and it's a very important power, is that I can see any record, any document that I need to see, including emails, if they're in relation to
work. You've got everything you asked for.
Exactly. We got everything
finally
we asked for. Exactly. And yes, so we were able to put together, I think, one of the more important pieces, because it illustrated so much of that report, was the chronology of events. And I think if you look through the chronology of events, you can see exactly what happened.
I was very astonished to see that you pointed out on 4 points where you said malmanagement.
Yes.
But what happened? Nothing.
Well, sometimes what an ombudsman is trying to do very often is change a culture. All right. There's an expression in English, in fact, I'm sure it's in every language, which is sometimes you lose the battle but win the war, in which you might not have immediately got a specific recommendation accepted, but you have set in train a cultural change, and that will, when the next time something like that happens, one hopes there will be a different outcome. And also I remember, actually, I was in the United States last year, and I was talking to some institutions, agencies that do, in different ways, the work that this office does in transparency, ethics, conflicts of interest, and so on. And I was talking to one agency and they were saying, you know, we do reports. And I said, what sanctions do you have? And they said, well, sometimes the sanction is the report itself. The mere fact that this has been shown to the light is sufficient. So while in a very narrow way, you could say that because the recommendation was rejected, therefore that was a problem. But I don't, not in a defensive way, I don't look upon it like that, because I think in future things will be done differently in the Commission.
But it was fascinating to realise there was no one apologising.
Well, I like to call that case, and I've called it publicly a few times, as an outlier case.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that, it was very different from the norm. It was very different in the way it was handled, in the way the Commission reacted to it.
The whole Commission, actually.
Yes, very different from the way we normally do business with the Commission. They don't always agree with us, but they don't agree with us in a particular way, and there's, you know, conversation, collaboration, and so on. And sometimes we manage to, you know, get a result that is, you know, you could say broadly satisfying to both sides or whatever. This was very different. And I think it was different because I think what was really happening in the Commission was this whole issue had become politicized, not by the European Ombudsman, but by decisions made by the Commission itself. And what you had ultimately in Martin Selmayr was a fusion and a fusing of the political post of chef de cabinet and the civil service post of secretary general. And of course one accepts that there has to be a certain rapport, shall we say, between secretary general and the person that they are reporting to in the form of the commission president. But I think it was seen that this perhaps was a little too strong in terms of the way that the roles coalesced.
No one questioned his capacity. He was skilled for the job. It was only the way things happened, correct?
Absolutely, and I make that point in the report that nobody was questioning his competence. I mean, he's obviously a highly qualified, highly competent, and highly trusted individual. Nobody was questioning that. But the public interest lay in this very important competition being conducted in a particular way.
I think that people, the staffs around in the Commission and elsewhere, now have to be more careful themselves.
In terms
of? How is my promotion or my wish to be promoted handled?
Well, look, nothing is ever completely black and white. Nothing is ever pure either. I mean, we're dealing with human beings and we're dealing with human nature. And of course, that enters into all of this. I mean, we don't select people by computer, and nor should we. Well, I don't know. But no, I think in general we shouldn't. And certainly not in a job that that is looking for particular, sometimes intangible qualities, and therefore you have to have this human piece in terms of the relationship or the interviews and all of that. You have to decide, do we want an independent civil service? Do we want a politicized civil service? Now, some countries have politicized civil services. That's fine, that's their choice. But you can't say you are one thing and then act in a different way. I mean, you know, if new laws were passed or there was a revision in the treaty that dictated a different kind of EU civil service, well, so be it. But don't pretend you're one thing and then do something else. And that was the problem.
You've been in the job quite long. Is this the worst case you have?
Well, I don't like to call it a worst case at all. And I mean,
or the most obvious case.
Well, I suppose in terms of the most visible cases, and of course we do an awful lot of work that is not visible really outside of an institution or of the person who has made the complaint or the organisation or whatever. I suppose in a somewhat similar high profile vein, we had the case of former Commission President Barroso a few years ago when he made the decision to accept a position with Goldman Sachs Bank. Now, he had waited 18 months after he'd stepped down as it said in the code of conduct, but the code of conduct is also linked to the treaty obligation on commissioners always to act with integrity and always protecting the reputation of the institutions and so on. And again, that was not something that I got involved in on my own initiative. We did get complaints actually from civil servants in the EU who, because shall we say Goldman Sachs is a controversial bank, was a controversial bank, and because it was implicated negatively in both in the financial crisis in the EU and also in the financial crisis, in the United States and also particularly in Greece, which had a snowballing effect, then there was a feeling that it was not appropriate that a former Commission President should have accepted
at least this not particular that quick. Post.
Well, I remember. Jean-Claude Juncker, who succeeded Mr. Barroso, saying something like, well, it's not that I wouldn't have accepted a job with a bank, just perhaps not that bank. That obviously attracted a lot of attention. And as well, I mean, one of the points I make consistently, and I made it during the Barroso case, and I made it during the commission appointment of the Secretary General case, the Martin Selmayr case, this looks bad, and this feeds the beast. This feeds Euroscepticism. This feeds anti-EU. This feeds a caricature of the EU, which is unfair. And I speak as somebody who is passionate. Sounds far too emotional a word for an ombudsman, but I'm very pro the EU. As an Irish woman, I certainly owe my public life very much to Ireland's decision in the early 1970s to join the EU.
And you're a former journalist.
Yes, exactly. Because it was because of the EU that Ireland was forced to get rid of its discriminatory legislation against women in the workplace, including the so-called marriage bar, which meant that if you were a public servant in Ireland as a woman, as soon as you got married, you had to leave. But anyway, so I'm very pro-EU. And therefore, when I see the EU, I'm aware of when it is being unfairly characterised. And those two cases, the Barroso case and the Selmayr case, they were both heavily mediated in anti-EU media.
Yeah. Now, not only in anti-EU media.
I'm making a point, particularly
they got
media.
The case.
Exactly. In other words, media that would not normally mediate ordinary EU events or even successes were handed, a gift.
You mentioned the possibility you have to take up on your own initiative cases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How dominant is that in the total amount of cases?
Very small. 90% of the work that we do would be with individual cases. Yes, exactly. We do the own initiative for two reasons. Sometimes we may get a series of complaints about a particular issue, so it's easier to deal with it in one investigation. That means that from now on, that problem isn't going to arise, and therefore we or the institution won't get complaints about it. And sometimes if we see that, and very often we do these investigations not to criticise but to be helpful, so we present solutions, for example, to the Commission in relation to how they go about their work. For example, there was one we did on the balance of the expert groups. There are about 800 expert groups who, of various shapes and sizes, who advise the Commission, because even though the EU civil service is sometimes described as gigantic or enormous, it isn't. It's actually quite small relative to member state civil services. So they need to get people in, and of course a lot of the issues they deal with are very highly technical or scientific or whatever, and if they don't have in-house knowledge, they have to reach out to others. So there had been, shall we say, some concerns raised in relation to, let's say, the gender balance or the geographical balance or the balance as between the public interest, civil society membership on some of the expert groups, or private interests and so on. So what we did essentially was to provide a template to the Commission as to how they could better rearrange these. So it's to be helpful, and it's also to end voluminous complaints about an issue which could be dealt with in one investigation.
Thank you. From a long time here we realized there's more, more than our own or what was given, more than the land or banner. As during the ages we grew, also in numbers, more and more, we astounded to learn, finding out about each manner. From hearts and lust for life, from hearts to the hereafter, we found the middle way, the path that led us all to glory. Giving up control, regaining with crying and with laughter, forsaking gods and nations, God found us. Our story. Europe is our world, our world is our Europe. This land is our true love, united but diverse. Europe is our life, identity and hope. Its nature sets the standard to true the universe.
Nobody denies that the Commission needs, and the parliamentarians as well, some kind of lobbyism. Mm. But the question when you're talking about the expert groups is that it is almost impossible to find out who's a member of an expert group.
It can be difficult, yes. And why lobbying, of course, is a perfectly legitimate function in any jurisdiction, because lawmakers cannot know all of the impacts that the laws they're making are going to have on, whether it's individuals, on communities, on businesses, and all of that. And so they have a responsibility to hear those views. So the issue is more about making sure that people know who's doing the influencing, how they're trying to influence, and what the result of the influencing is.
Most lobbyists are registered.
Yeah.
But the experts are not.
Well, that's true. Yes. And therefore, it's one of the parts of the piece that we did in the investigation into expert groups was to help the Commission to assess and deal with conflicts of interest. Now, very often, I mean, we deal with a lot of the regulatory bodies as well, you know, the Chemicals Agency, Medicines Agency, and the Food and Safety Agency, very important agencies. And they often make the point that, look, because, you know, academic excellence or scientific excellence and expertise is often connected with business for perfectly legitimate reasons, it can be very difficult to get a pure scientist or a pure expert in whatever to come. And also, they benefit from their exposure to commercial reality. So it's you know, mutually helpful, and we acknowledge that, of course, and we do accept that at times there will have to be experts who do have links to business, but it's that those links should be known and that they should be managed. It's as simple as that. It's not to be so pure that you're actually damaging the public interest by not getting the best people in to advise.
You are traveling a lot. You're going to one congress or meeting after the other. What can you learn?
Well, I don't travel as much as some, and partly because I hate flying, actually. So, So I have seen an awful lot of Europe on train. Of course, when you live in Ireland, it's lovely living in middle Europe because you can get to everywhere on train. So I've travelled to Warsaw on the train, and I've travelled to Barcelona and all sorts of places. And it's a wonderful way to travel.
You're saving a lot of environmental damage.
Well, yes, but I'm not going to pretend that that is why I do it. It's a wonderful, fallout of that. But anyway, yes, when do I go and what do I go? Well, I choose where I go strategically. I visit a lot of my ombudsman colleagues in the member states.
And
also,
you even have an annual meeting of ombudsmen.
Yes, and we have that in Brussels, because I decided before I came the meeting would be in one of the member states, and I thought, well, the point of the European Ombudsman and the European network is because we're all in the EU. So for the last several years they have come very kindly to Brussels, where we try and bring commissioners and administrators and all that, MEPs, so that they can have conversations with the faceless Brussels bureaucrats.
But in which way does the work of ombudspersons differ?
In what sense?
From one country or the other?
That's a good question.
Different.
I mean, in the more Nordic countries, it's a lot
where
more...
Where it comes from?
Yes, of course. Yes, a lot more, shall we say, legalistic. In other words, it tends to be very... they tend to have precise codes of administrative law and so on. So it's a lot more precise and regulation based than in other countries which don't have, such as the EU, we don't have a code, a law of administrative procedure. So it's slightly different. It can differ sometimes in terms of the powers that ombudsmen have. You find that in countries where the rule of law isn't particularly strong and where there is an attempt to embed democratic values and the rule of law more strongly, then there is a tendency to give the ombudsman very strong powers. Whereas in countries where the rule of law is embedded, strong, accepted, all of that, the ombudsman has weaker powers, more recommendatory than making binding decisions. But I often say that the ombudsman can be a bit like the canary in the mine, sent in to see if there's poison there. Of course, when I use that analogy, I have to realize that sometimes the canary dies in the mine as well when it's warning that. So it differs. It depends. It very much depends on the country. I think in the best functioning democracies, the ombudsman is based on soft law, on an acceptance of their legitimacy within the wider architecture, the wider institutional architecture. And in countries where all of that is embedded, then you will find a very, very high percentage of recommendations being accepted.
And where do you see yourself in that context?
I would see more towards the latter, towards soft law recommendations, and because within the EU there's no law of administrative procedure, my predecessor drew up a code of administrative procedure, so it's a little more fluid, shall we say, than in other countries. But, I mean, essentially I think the job is very simple of an ombudsman. You're making sure that the institutions do what they're supposed to do. It's really simple. They have their treaties, they have their conventions, they have their constitutions perhaps, they have their laws, they have their codes and principles, and all of the institutions who are supposed to abide by those, if they come under your mandate, then your job is to make sure that they actually do that. And there are different mechanisms for doing it in different countries, but essentially our role is pretty much the same.
I heard some rumours that there is coming up a commissioner for children. That could be linked, or that's a question. Do you have any special connections with cases involving children?
Well, no, because there are in many countries there are ombudsmen for children, dealing with problems specific to children, whether in health, education, and all of that. And there's also a network actually based in Strasbourg for that. We wouldn't specifically get complaints in relation to children, because if they were about social protection, health, all of that, those are competencies of the member states, and therefore we wouldn't get them here. We might get them in a very general way in relation to perhaps migration issues or something like that, if it comes to a European agency or Frontex or something like that, but never a specific child, as would be the case with Ombudsman for Children.
We have here in Strasbourg another European institution, the Council of Europe.
Yes.
Are you in any way cooperating with their people, their staff, when it comes to things where you should be involved?
Yes, we do. We have regular liaisons with them. I've spoken in the chamber a few times, and my colleagues, are regularly talking with them. Yes, there are certain common themes that we would discuss around transparency. Also, they've done quite a lot of work on the institution of the Ombudsman itself, globally, trying to draw up norms in relation to the appointment of ombudsmen, the independence of ombudsmen, all of those issues, because they see that the institution of the ombudsman is very important in the human rights, democracy, rule of law, in that arena. They see it as a pivotal institution, and therefore they've done quite a lot of work
on
it.
But here comes the differences in culture.
In terms of the Council of Europe countries? Yes, of course. Well, I mean, it's much wider than the EU. Obviously, it encompasses every, so there are particular challenges there.
So, do you foresee that it can be implemented like that everywhere?
The Ombudsman?
Yeah.
Well, it can be, but it depends on what type of a beast it is. You could have a nominal Ombudsman, but without much independence, heavily politicized, starved of resources. So therefore, are you an ombudsman? I mean, the question that is often discussed among ombudsmen is whether, let's say you have an ombudsman in a country that is not particularly strong or might be being very much under the thumb of the administration. Well, do you give them the stamp of approval through membership of a network, or do you insist on, no, come back to us when you're fully independent, when you're properly resourced, and blah, blah, blah. And of course, the arguments for the former is that they will be assisted if we give them the stamp of approval, and that'll help them to, that will put pressure on the administration to make them stronger and more independent. The other argument is that, no, it allows the administration to claim that, whoa, we're perfect, we have an ombudsman. It depends which side you lean on.
Let's come to finalizing this interview. Do you foresee any kind of, or do you hope for any kind of development of the institution of the EU ombudsperson?
Well, I think, institutions wither if there isn't development, yes. I mean, there is a... changes have already in train in a new statute that has been accepted by Parliament but still has to go through Council and the Commission. I mean, I like to describe this office as a small office with a big mandate, and that is precisely what it is. I mean, we're, 70 people, and yet, you have the Charter of Fundamental Rights, references the Ombudsman, the right to good administration. The Ombudsman emerged from the Maastricht Treaty around European citizenship and all of that. And when you think about it, the role of the Ombudsman within the EU is to be, the watchdog, the guardian of the public interest in that particular, in relation to good administration. So that is a huge role. So I would be hopeful over time that the institutions will see the even greater potential of the office and will allow it to grow and develop even further.
Du har lyttet til den tredje og sidste udsendelse i udsendelsesrækken om de tre EU-institutioner. Den første var om EU-domstolen og EU-retten, den anden om EU-revisionsretten, alle tre beliggende i Luxembourg, mens denne samtale, det var med den irske EU-ombudskvinde Emily O'Reilly, som europakorrespondent Peter von Kohl besøgte på hendes kontor i Europaparlamentets Václav Havel-bygning i parlamentets hjemby, som ligger i det franske Strasbourg. Samtalen her var produceret af Peter von Kohl, og udsendelserne er støttet af Europanævnet.